I think we've covered most of the Jewish participants at Bettis Lab. Is there any other that you can think of, either by name or at least in any degree?
Well, at the Atomic Power Division.
No, I meant finishing up with Bettis.
Right now I can't think of any other, but I don't know.
There was one, the one who succeeded Taylor.
Do you want to mention Fred Forscher?
Mention Fred Forscher.
There was Fred Forscher. Hmm. I'd rather have it in your voice.
Well, there's another one who was there, one of the troops, Izzy Cullen.
Izzy Cullen?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He worked for Shapiro most of the time. Mm-hmm. Or no, worked for Lustman.
Worked for...
Mm-hmm. He's a metallurgist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But in the chemistry area, there weren't too many.
Mm-hmm. And the guy who replaced Taylor.
The
Tree of Life.
He's gone now, but one of the guys there who was very good was Yale Solomon.
Oh, yes. Yale Solomon.
Yeah, and he worked in the commercial later, too.
Later in commercial.
Yeah,
and then later at EPRI.
Yeah.
Commercial, then EPRI. The Tree of Life dark haired guy. Well, we all had dark, I guess, upon that Tree of Life who replaced Taylor. J.J. Taylor. And this is the wrong voice. It's mine, not yours.
At APD, of course, there was Ted Stern, Dave Fax, Shep Bartnoff.
Yeah, Ted Stern. Mm-hmm. Dave Fax, Shep Bartnoff.
Yeah. Arnold Kitsis worked for me.
Yeah, Arnold Kitsis. Right, I remember him.
And I can't remember too many others.
Kitsis, who? It was KITZIS.
CES.
CES.
ZES.
ZES.
You didn't get Shep last name.
Shep Bartnoff. B-A-R-T-N-O-F-F.
N-O-F-F.
Yeah.
Arnold Kitsis, who worked for me, who...
Arnold worked for me.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Oh. Uh-huh. Oh, let's see who else was there. I can't think of... Oh. What the heck is it? I got a sort of a Spanish name. Still at Westinghouse. The guy who handled the in-house R&D program.
Sure.
He lives on Meckley Avenue, right on the corner there in Aylesboro.
Mm-hmm. I have mental... He's at Young People's.
No, he
isn't. Hmm? What I'm thinking of is... We seem to have run out of the names. I wouldn't mind repeating them just a bit. Ted Stern was, in case we don't get it anywhere else, was what?
Stern was in the mechanical department, as was Fax and Bartnoff were in the so-called plant department.
Yeah.
And Ted...
Fax, yeah.
Dave ended up as a consultant at R&D. Bartnoff left, ultimately became president of...
Bartnoff became...
president of the utility.
Yes, Jersey Central.
Yeah, Jersey Central Power Line.
Yeah.
And Ted Stern, of course, is now executive vice president. Runs the whole nuclear program.
Executive VP for all power generation, or Westinghouse power generation, right? And Barkinoff. Others? Any other specific technical programs of that you had that you want to name as the name of the thing you worked in? Anything at either at APD, that is the water reactors part?
Well, one of the things I did was run the radiation test program at, over a period of about 10 years.
Where?
At Bettis. I spent, a bit over time, spent about $10 million just on facilities, and I ran responsible for the operation. And this was all over. That's where I did a lot of work in Canada.
Oh, yes. In Canada, what happened?
Well, I think I explained earlier that
yeah.
there was a lack of adequate test facilities in the United States in the early days, so that the Atomic Energy Commission made arrangements with the Atomic Energy of Canada Limited to utilize reactor facilities in Canada. And I had the responsibility for liaison and designing and installing the test facilities in Canada and up and
which were
supervising their operation.
At where?
They were at Chalk River.
At Chalk River.
Laboratories.
Yeah. At Chalk River. River Laboratory. What year was that, do you remember?
Oh, it started in 1950.
1950.
Yeah. Continues to this day.
Yeah, to this day.
Well, I don't run it.
Yeah. Yeah. And was there one particular program that was up there that I could identify?
Well, we did a number of programs. I tested the first prototype fuel bundle for the STR up at Chalk River. And we did all the shipping port fuel development tests at Chalk River. And then we subsequently did the fuel bundle tests at Chalk River too.
Wait a minute. Okay.
And one of the contributions, which was just an aside, and was incidental to our other objectives, in order to utilize and get the best use of the reactors testing, I developed and had constructed a zirconium alloy thimble, pressure thimble for the test program at Chalk River. And of course, this was very important to the Canadians because their whole reactor design is based on the idea of using a zirconium alloy pressure tube. It was very amusing. When we put it in, we had to give the Canadians a design limit. And I went around and shopped everybody, you know, as to how long they thought we should leave it in there. And we came up fairly arbitrarily with figure of 2 years. And then when the 2 years were up, the Canadians realized that that was the longest exposure of material of that type for that purpose anywhere in the world, and so they didn't want to take it out. So he said, you're on your own now.
How long did it last, you remember?
Oh, they took it out, I think, after 5 years or so.
Mm-hmm. they identify the isotropy of zinc and anisotropy in that test?
Well, I don't know. They went to other alloys for their commercial. Stronger alloys for their commercial.
Yeah, they would have had to.
And they went to zinc tail. But the whole idea was... Actually, we had a little... The first loop I put in the Chalk River, part of the deal to sweeten it for the Canadians, and put a little... The Canadians added on a little electric generating system so they could say that they were making nuclear electric power. It wasn't part of our... but we selected a cooling system which we were able to do that.
Do you remember who you worked with there, name of a guy?
Oh, well, the man I worked with most of the time, like W.B. Lewis, which is now dead.
W.B.
Lewis.
B, I remember him. Yeah, he was a very inspiring guy.
Yeah, he was the director of the laboratory. Mm-hmm.
He was the exponent of the unenriched D2O plant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the one they went to. Mm-hmm.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
As a listener to what's going on, what's not clear, why are you up in Canada representing this government, helping them?
We weren't helping them. We were utilizing their unique facility that they had.
Oh, I see.
And so part of the deal, I remember when I went up there in December of 1950, there was a team of us, a couple of us that went up there, and made the deal with the did the exploratory talks with the Canadians about utilizing their reactor. They were their motivation was that they were at the crossroads. You know, they had built this nuclear laboratory as part of the British strategy on the bomb, because the British were not sure, you know, that they could survive the German attacks. So they decided to initiate and support a parallel effort in nuclear technology in Canada. And Lewis was sent over to direct that afterwards, and at the end of the war. He didn't start it, but at the end of the war. And they had built a very, very fine test reactor. Incidentally, they were making plutonium and selling it to the United States. But they didn't know what to do with it. They had nowhere to go. And then manna from heaven, along comes a guy who says, "Hey, I'd like to use your reactor for testing some of my fuel, etc. And we're going to use it in the power plant." Hello! Now, we had to maintain secrecy and all that sort of stuff. It was a very interesting arrangement. But I had a lot of fun.
Was Lewis an Englishman?
Yes. And I made some friends. I still see them. This summer we were up in Victoria, and I spent an afternoon with one of my old Canadian friends who lives up in that area.
What was Meridian, one of them?
Oh, I knew Meridian, but he was not an early factor. Did you go to Whitechapel?
Yes, I did. All right. I can't think of anything I want to follow up with. I'll let you...
I'll have to find that Vita. I have a copy of the Vita someplace.
Okay.
You think that's it? Well, all you have on here is another...
Whether you covered my early years in Pittsburgh and I worked for years long.
Yeah.
We covered that already. Well, it's come around full circle because there's a tremendous interest now in coal burning and purification and, you know, some of the things that I worked on in the Bureau of Mines back in under the technical microscope again. And in view of what's happened to nuclear. So yeah. the coal business, etc. Mm-hmm. Got a new lease on life. Mm-hmm. This energy center at Pitt, you know, is all involved in that.
But are you saying coal may make a rebound?
Well, coal, something has to supply the energy, and if it isn't nuclear, it's going to be gas. Or we don't want it to be oil, because we don't have enough oil. But right now, in the United States, we consume more energy in the form of gas than we do in the form of domestic oil.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the gas supplies look pretty good for some time, but there's a great deal of effort and of interest in the burning of coal, cleanly, et cetera, et cetera. But we run into this environmental thing. During all of these years, nobody, you know, we didn't pay the bill, you know, for all of the damage that we were doing and the waste we were generating and whatnot. There were a lot of hidden costs that weren't paid. And the way they're adding up now, my God, if you took them out of the, at any reasonable rate, if you took them out of the gross national product, we're a poor country. Hmm. If we spend, start to spend what it takes to clean this country up, we'll be a poor country. And part of that is in the nuclear program, but mostly in the weapons program. The weapons program is terrible.
How do you feel about the nuclear waste, or did we ask you that?
What's I think it's manageable. I think that the we've got a very peculiar social, socio-legal structure in the United States, where it's where small, organized interest groups basically establish policy, not the general public. So the people who are against nuclear or against waste, I don't know what they think the alternative is. They don't come up with any alternatives. But it's all small groups because they can be heard and they can organize and, you know, supply a voice. Well, the general public doesn't speak, I mean. There ain't no such thing as the general public speaking out. You can't press a button and get the views of the general public. But if you want the views of the anti-Schmo League, very simple. You just call them up and you'll be flooded with paper. Mm. And they'll send you speakers, etc. And the problem is that though we have a very representative government in the forms of congressmen who are elected locally, they respond that way. They have the same difficulty of reading the public pulse, etc. And they don't do the things they ought to do. The fact of the matter is that the whole environmental problem basically is a, and the nuclear problem is a political problem. And the governor of Massachusetts, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just relicensed one of the reactors, which was shut down for repairs for about 2 years, major reconstruction. Now, here we have a commission which is established by Congress to regulate the safety and determine and validate, you know, the safety of nuclear power. Mm-hmm. And they license a plant, and the government, governor of Massachusetts is going into court to fight the relicensing because he's against nuclear power, mm-hmm. or what have you, for safety.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty absurd thing.
Well, isn't the public frightened because they're not getting educated on it. No one's telling them the true facts of nuclear power.
I don't know that no one's. I think that's a misstatement. There's a plethora of facts, rumors, opinions, and whatnot. The public has been bombarded with information on these issues. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, the public is not capable of understanding a large fraction of even the simplest concepts that are associated with nuclear power, or for that matter, any other technology, etc. In a recent survey, 28% of the people interviewed thought that the sun rotated around the Earth. Mm-hmm. The state of scientific education in the United States is absolutely deplorable. We have a small layer up at the top, which is probably as good as the corresponding small layer of every place else. And then you have a whole bunch of boobus Americanas. And they are, they're afraid of everything. And not only that, they do not have the capacity to analyze their own actions, their own attitudes, for instance. Nobody thinks about anything of getting into an automobile, even though your chance of getting killed in an automobile accident far exceeds
anything
else. And if you want to blame the nuclear industry for not solving the psychological problem of of the masses, then that's it. But the other industries have demonstrated at various times they don't know any better. Mm-hmm. And people don't look at things dispassionately, and they don't analyze, don't understand their actions. They can't even connect the fact that if they reject action A, they are maybe automatically committing themselves to action B, because there is no alternative.
Well, that's pretty important, I think.
Well, the industry castigated itself and decided it wasn't doing a good job. It was very hard for the technical person who is aware and can put a lot of this stuff into perspective why other people can't do the same. You know what I mean? But they can't, etc. And then, of course, there are zealots on both sides. Now, they made a lot of mistakes, but then they always make mistakes. Look what the chemical industry and the oil industry did on waste.
Mm-hmm. Well, we covered quite a bit there. I wish I could think of something else. How about you, Howard?
I liked this last bit of philosophy on public understanding.
Yeah, I think that
I thought
was good.
It was extremely nicely put.
Yeah.
But I don't know that you can change that too much. Mm-hmm. I think back when I went to school. To grade school and high school, etc. I really didn't know what the stupid people were doing, because I didn't move in that circle. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And maybe there was just a large fraction of the non-learners, you know what I mean? Or the non engaged in school then as we have now, or a substantial fraction. I just wasn't aware of it because I was engaged, I was involved in and engaged in the educational process for whatever reason, whether it was genetic or family or what have you. But I must confess that I just didn't know now. There are a lot of guys, you know, you always had guys that didn't do well in school, you know what I mean? But that has probably just gotten worse. And of course, you look at the people from the lower economic status, there's no connection. They're not engaged, they don't see any connection, except in a rare instance, and they don't develop. And society, I think, has been slow and found out that it was a very difficult process to modify that, to get them interested.
Well, I've been connected with a school for the last 6 years, 9 to 12th grades, and I can tell you if they are showing us where the students are headed, and they're headed downhill. They know nothing about history, even though the school wants them. They can't tell you where the coast of New York is. They don't even know it's on the Atlantic Ocean.
No, I mean, they know nothing. They know nothing. They only know pop culture.
Right. This is true at all these schools.
Pop culture, and they don't read, and they watch TV. It's isolated.
But there are exceptions.
Well, I say there's always there's cream at the top of every bottle of milk, but you got to remember it's skim milk down below.
Of course, didn't they say that in Rome years ago? Something like that?
Well, the fact of the matter is that it may be characteristic of Homo sapiens. You know, no civilization has persisted in the history of mankind. And, you know, there's an old saying, you know, they said Rome fell to the Goths. But no, Rome fell to the Romans.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. I mean, man dies of his own excesses.
Well, could you say that the Jews in some way are an exception to that? They survive as a race, but not as a nation like Rome.
Well, the religion has survived. The culture has survived. It's probably that and the Chinese are the two oldest cultures, civilized in the world. They have persisted, etc. And they may or may not last too much longer. Every time I open the Chronicle, there's an article on how terrible, you know, assimilation and mixed marriage and all that sort of stuff. And there's no universal law which says it has to. There's no law which says it has to. And or rule that enforced by anything. And the strong strain of intellectualism among the Jews is, I think, is watering down. That is, as you get, you still have a very strong strain, but as people move in to have greater opportunity, a lot of the Jewish characteristics probably resulted from their isolation. But as this has disappeared in many areas, I think so has the characteristics gotten watered down. But you always had the Jewish lumping, you know, laborers and whatnot, uneducated people, etc. Either for lack of opportunity or a lack of desire. I mean, it wasn't a pure strain. Mm-hmm. And
somehow they left a mark in the arts and music.
Well, their contribution to music is substantial, but not, let's say, it's probably in proportion to their numbers, it's very high. They aren't the major contributors, of course, to anything.
Except to Judenphysik.
What?
Except to Judenphysik.
Well, that's not quite true either. If you go back and you look at the physics, you'll find that there are Germans and Danes and what have you, all in there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few.
Mm. Yeah, only for a short time, blip in time, in fact. You're right, certainly from perhaps 1880 on to 1900.
Well, I mean, Einstein was unique. His contributions.
Mm.
But chemistry, that wasn't the case. There are lots of great Jewish chemists, but they only represent a small fraction
of the
chemistry panorama.
Mm. Paul Ehrlich?
Well,
contribution, but still limited.